Petrushka was played there by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Thierry Fisher. Today's Discovering Music was presented by Stephen Johnson. It was produced by Sam Phillips and first broadcast in August last year. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just after 6:30, time to return to the Royal Albert Hall for our second prom today, presented by Andrew McGregor.
Two nights of illicit passion packed into a single prom. That's what we're promised this evening here at the Royal Albert Hall in Sir Simon Rattle's first visit of the season. He's conducting the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, exploring two great romantic scores on period instruments, works by Berlioz and Wagner that were partly inspired by their own love stories and led to their musical portrayals of two tragic couples, Romeo and Juliet and Tristan and Isolde. In Berlioz's case, his introduction to Shakespeare on stage in 1827 hit him like a thunderbolt, especially because of the Irish actress Harriet Smithson, who for him so perfectly embodied Juliet. Berlioz was obsessed by her. But it was to be 12 years before he was able to turn Romeo and Juliet into a choral symphony from which we're going to hear the orchestral movement describing the love scene in Shakespeare's play. Wagner, meanwhile, was infatuated with Matilda Wesendonck, and his opera Tristan und Isolde is a powerful evocation of his yearning for her as she kept him at arm's length. In the second part of the prom, we'll hear the whole of the second act of Tristan, the great love duet. Tristan und Isolde are sung by Ben Heppner and Violetta Urmana. So what are their thoughts on performing Wagner with period instruments?
I think we thought when we began rehearsals that, the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment with the gut strings and the original wooden flutes and things, it would sound like a string quartet, you know, so we'd have no trouble at all. But believe me, they can put out sound. And in the first rehearsals we had at St. Luke, it was astonishingly big. It was as big as any orchestra I've worked with.
Ben Heppner, this evening's Tristan, and we'll hear the results for ourselves after the interval. First, though, Berlioz does Shakespeare, and in the love scene from Romeo and Juliet, he does without the singers and allows the orchestra alone to portray the young lovers' night together. And here to conduct the love scene from Berlioz's Romeo and Juliet is one of the three principal artists who conduct the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, shaking hands with leader Matthew Truscott, Sir Simon Rattle. So, picture a serene night in the silent and deserted Capulet Garden. The love scene from Hector Berlioz's dramatic symphony Romeo and Juliet. Love Across the Barricades from Shakespeare's play, triumphing all too briefly over the divisions between their families, the Montagues and Capulets. And the love scene was performed for us at the Proms by the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. Here he comes back onto the platform. And the very first thing he did at the end of the love scene was to walk into the centre of the orchestra and gesture towards the winds, and especially the cello section, for their ardent portrayal of Romeo himself. Berlioz seems to have been especially proud of what we've just heard. Writing in 1858, he said, "If you ask me which of my works I prefer, my answer is the love scene in Romeo and Juliet," which must have always had special significance for him, as he was eventually to marry his own Juliet, the actress Harriet Smithson. Well, if you found yourself thinking that Berlioz's music for Romeo and Juliet seems to be looking forward to Wagner, then Wagner himself admitted as much. He was in his mid-20s when he called Berlioz's Romeo and Juliet the revelation of a new world of music, and will be plunged into Wagner's musical world after the interval, the second act of his opera Tristan und Isolde, the ecstatic duet for the two lovers, sung this evening by Violetta Umana and Ben Heppner. Until then, let's join Rana Mitter for more of the Proms Literary Festival.
Welcome to the Proms Literary Festival here at the Royal College of Music. And tonight, we're creating our own Summer of Love, literary style. We'll be asking, what makes a really great love story, inspired as Wagner and Berlioz were by two of the great tragic love stories of Western civilization? Tristan and Isolde, the knight and the queen, whose affair was the one thing out of Cornwall hotter than a fresh-baked pasty. And Romeo and Juliet, the tragic teens, whose story would have ended so much better if their nurse had just spent a bit more time in pharmacy school. But why have they come to symbolise romance? And what are those elements that make up the timeless classic love story? Well, to answer that, and also to choose their own personal favourite literary love affairs, I'm joined by two guests. Howard Jacobson is one of Britain's darkest, funniest novelists. His latest novel, The Finkler Question, is on the long list for this year's Man Booker Prize. And over the years, the heroes of his novels have been looking, mostly in vain, for love everywhere from the Australian outback to a Midlands polytechnic. Then, to sort out our eros from our agape, we're delighted to have Mary Beard, Professor of Classics at Cambridge University, whose expertise includes romance and much more in the Roman world. And our readings are brought to life by an actress who's been nominated for a Tony and an Olivier for her stage work, Hayden Gwynn. Do please welcome them all tonight. Howard, let's get to the heart of the matter. What is it that makes up a really good love story?
An impediment. There has to be something in the way of the love ever being fulfilled, happy. Even when we have a story which ends happily, we've not really believed in it as a love story, unless somewhere or other we think, well, the author has intervened there and made something happen that wouldn't normally happen. All the great love affairs are about frustration, the numbers of ways in which this love affair is stopped from happening. It's why we do it. We do it because we're not allowed, because it's impossible, and so on.
So, Mary, is that right, that it's basically difficulty that creates the lasting nature of the love story?
If you want to go beyond that, I guess the ancients would have thought that violence was quite a good bit to add to the mixture. And in some ways, I think the greatest ancient love story is going to be Medea. Medea is going to be ditched by Jason. And it's a story, as love stories always risk being, it's also a story of revenge, and in that case, it's the death.
It's not just the death of other people, it's the death of them. The great love stories are about wanting to die. Romeo and Juliet talk about death almost before they meet. They talk about night all the time, and night becomes the symbol of death. Night becomes the symbol of the impossibility. And Tristan and Isolde is entirely about death. They're not interested in each other. If you asked Tristan to describe Isolde, he wouldn't have a clue what she was wearing or what she looked like. Ditto the other way around. What they are in love with is the idea of dying together, gaining a kind of immortality through their love. Tristan and Isolde, they say. Isolde and Tristan. Together we will... singly we will die, but together, when we're joined by this and, we will live forever. But before they get to the living forever, they want to die.
Yes.
I mean, sex is about death, and romantic sex is about death big time.
Now, I think that's a good moment at which we should get our love doctors to get down to case studies. Now, Mary, as your first example of a favourite love story, you've chosen a fragment from the Greek poet Sappho. Could you tell us a little bit more to set the scene for this reading?
This is the earliest love poem in the Western tradition and sets the scene for all the rest. It's written probably the end of the 7th or early 6th century BC. And it's written by a woman about her beloved, who is a woman. It's woman to woman. But the obstacle in that case is the man next to whom the desired object is sitting.
Right, thanks, Mary. Hayden, would you read to us from Sappho's poem On Jealousy?
He seems to me equal to the gods, that man. Whoever he is, who opposite you sits and listens close to your sweet speaking and lovely laughing, oh, it puts my heart in my chest on wings. For when I look at you, even a moment, no speaking is left in me. No, tongue breaks and thin fire is racing under skin, and in eyes no sight, and drumming fills ears, and cold sweat holds me, and shaking grips me all. Greener than grass I am, and dead. Or almost, I seem to me.
Thank you, Hayden. Sappho's On Jealousy, translated by Anne Carson. Mary, why is this poem so meaningful to you?
Well, somehow you could dispense with every other love poem after it, I think. You know, it's a marvellous example of the whole tradition being born whole at one time. I mean, this has got the obstacle, and this is the story of love already conceived as being the story of love against an obstacle. It's got the kind of solipsism. It's all about he seems to me, I seem to me. And most of the poem is not about the desired object. It's about what it feels like for me to be frustrated in love of the desired object. But also, just there's one kind of third thing which I think we probably tend to take for granted in the poem. I mean, it sounds terribly standard, you know, can't speak and more shivery and sweat. And I think we tend to forget that this is the first time ever in Western literature that someone told us that those were the symptoms of love. And ever after, we have copied Sappho when we wanted to be in love. You know, how do I know I'm in love? It's because my tongue is all thinking, oh, I'm shaking.
And I'm dead.
I'm dead.
Howard, I wonder if you could pick up that idea of Mary's, that in some ways these early examples of literature teach us as later readers and later writers how it is that we write about love. I mean, do you find yourself as a writer about love in that tradition?
Yes, absolutely I do, and I think what Mary said is absolutely right, that we learn how to love from reading about love, and we learn how to love from speaking about love, and I think love and language are extremely closely intertwined, so that we often fall in love with the language of love as we speak it. And the more articulate lovers are, this isn't to say that lovers who don't have words won't also be in love, but lovers with words will be more in love, with more intensely in love. And that's partly to do with, that's partly how language works in love. It works in jealousy. People's jealousy feeds on language, and people's desperate passion feeds on the language of desperation. So you need the language, and you need to have read the books. How people fall in love who haven't done a degree in literature at university, I don't know.
No, they go to movies.
And now, a case of understated passion and resentment in this extract from Persuasion by Jane Austen. And Howard, this is one of your choices. I wonder if you could set the scene for us.
Yes, and I just want to say that I've chosen Jane Austen because it seems to me that she's highly underestimated as a writer about love and even eroticism. It is assumed that because she writes these elegant 18th century sentences that she is not writing about passion at its most intense. That's wrong. This is a scene from Persuasion, the saddest and really most tragic of Jane Austen's novels, in which Anne Elliot has not seen Mr. Wentworth for 10 years. They were in love. She calls the relationship off because she's advised against him. They meet again 10 years later. They barely look at each other. She doesn't know what he's thinking, and this happens.
Yes, he had done it. She was in the carriage and felt that he had placed her there, that his will and his hands had done it, that she owed it to his perception of her fatigue and his resolution to give her rest. She was very much affected by the view of his disposition towards her, which all these things made apparent. This little circumstance seemed the completion of all that had gone before. She understood him. He could not forgive her, but he could not be unfeeling. Though condemning her for the past and considering it with high and unjust resentment, though perfectly careless of her, and though becoming attached to another, still he could not see her suffer without the desire of giving her relief. It was a remainder of former sentiment. It was an impulse of pure, though unacknowledged, friendship. It was proof of his own warm and amiable heart, which she could not contemplate without emotion so compounded of pleasure and pain that she knew not which prevailed.
It's unbelievably poignant. I mean, I almost swoon hearing this. That picture of her not being able to say anything and knowing that things have happened to her. Yes, he had done it. She's in a state of extreme passivity. I wouldn't quite call it erotic passivity, but it's partly that. His hands are doing things to her. He's putting her in a place. It's very, very touchy-feely, actually, without her actually saying, he touched her here, as a modern novelist would do. He touched her there. It's just this sense of her being moved by another person's hands. It's an act of extreme consideration, as told by and as felt by a highly intelligent and sensitive woman, highly conscious of all this. The pleasure and the pain is part. The pain is partly because here's a man she once loved and feels she's wronged, and therefore cannot expect to be loved by him anymore. The pleasure might be, well, she's been touched by him. They still are there. There's still a physical connection, maybe, and maybe there's a compound too of just the possibility, which the novel is wonderfully good about, just the possibility that it might fire up again. It just might fire up again.
Howard, when I was reading this passage, I was actually reminded in an odd way of a novel which for me, in a sense, is, you know, the great go-to love story of poignancy, which is F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. And I was trying to think what brought them together in my mind. And to me, it's the detail. It's the level of detail and the understatedness. But I wonder if that means that these stories, the Austen or maybe the Fitzgerald, can't be mythic. They can't go beyond themselves because it is about the literary journey rather than necessarily about the story the narrative, the story itself in both cases.
Well, I know what you're saying, and they can't be mythic perhaps the impossibility is not as grand as we like it to be in Romeo and Juliet and Tristan and Isolde. But this really is an impossibility. This, in this one, is the story of a love that was thrown away in an age when you don't get a second chance. Jane Austen's heroines lived at a time when you got it right or you never got it right again. The wonderful gift that Jane Austen gives us is to say, I will buy, it's almost a Cinderella thing, but done with such competence you don't want to call it. She gives her the second chance, but I think there is a mythic quality here because there isn't really a second chance. It's over. And this is the story of longing for somebody. And that's the impediment here to this too. It's gone. It's finished. And the erotic component of this is the longing for somebody that will never be yours ever again.
Now we have a very modern version of a very ancient story with this extract from Eurydice by the poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy.
Girls, forget what you've read. It happened like this. I did everything in my power to make him look back. What did I have to do, I said, to make him see we were through? I was dead, deceased. I was resting in peace, passé, late, past my sell-by date. And here I stretched out my hand and touched him once on the back of the neck. Please let me stay. But already the light had saddened from purple to grey. It was an uphill schlep from death to life. And with every step I willed him to turn. I'd managed to filch the poem out of his cloak when inspiration finally struck. I stopped, thrilled. He was a yard in front. My voice shook when I spoke. Orpheus, your poem's a masterpiece. I'd love to hear it again. He was smiling modestly when he turned. When he turned and he looked at me. What else? I noticed he hadn't shaved. I waved once and was gone. The dead are so talented. The living walk by the edge of a vast lake near the wise, drowned silence of the dead.
Well, the real myth, that's real in inverted commas, is the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, blissfully in love. Eurydice dies, taken to Hades. Orpheus, the great poet, musician, wants to get her back, manages to negotiate a deal with the gods of the underworld. She can come back, he can go and get her, but he must take her up to the light, never once turning round to look at her, and he just can't resist. So poor old Eurydice has to go back down to Hades forever. But I have to say, I thought there was... I chose this because it was time for a bit of kind of feminist realism to be injected into all our kind of... all the flutterings in our breast. Because like it or not, most of these great love stories are men's stories about the women of their desires.
So Eurydice's not really very keen to be saved by the man with the lyre, but at the same time, doesn't that make this really the ultimate anti-romance?
I don't see it as anti-romance because I think it still evokes for me, even if against the grain, that idea of Orpheus's passion.
I mean, I think this is an absolutely brilliant, funny poem. It is utterly brilliant, and for me, it's vile. I loathe it. I loathe it. It proves it's sneering. It's sneering at a man. Man has to copy it again. If a man wrote this poem about the other way around, about a woman, women would be up in arms. But leave that aside. Let's leave the politics aside and say simply this. Politics and love do not go together. I can't imagine a more anti-love document. It's brilliant. It's a little poem of genius, but quite what it's doing in a love collection, I don't know. And it proves that it's funny, and it proves you can't have a great love with comedy either. Comedy murders it. Comedy dispels it, and politics dispels it anymore. So at the end of this, you've got no love left whatsoever.
Howard, is that a definitive statement there? Are you saying that a great love can never be comic? As a comic novelist yourself.
I'm not saying that the lovers might not be able to make the odd joke together, but I think in the depiction of a great, and we are talking about a great Rome, if Tristan and Isolde, if someone around Tristan and Isolde, if Wagner could have made a joke, that would have been the end of that opera. There's no way in which you could have comedy in the Berlioz Romeo and Juliet. It's not possible. There is comedy in Romeo and Juliet, of course, affected by other people, but they are inured from it, the lovers themselves. Love, this is not a description of what it's like to live our lives in the daily way, but if we are to understand love as this desperate thing which knows, which is death-born, death-bound, and wants only death, jokes and politics kill it.
Come on, Howard. If Caroline Duffy gets to hear about your reaction, I think she'll be extremely pleased because she will say, right, I told you so, the one thing that male writers about love don't ever recognise is that they have done over the millennia to the women of their dreams exactly what I've done to Orpheus here, in a way. And I think that somehow, as I say, the arresting nature of this shows how important it is that someone's going to say, come on, tell it from the other side.
But it just means she's not in love. I mean, all you're saying is she's not in love. Eurydice is not in love with Orpheus. That's fine. She's rejected his love. And rejection is often comic, and rejection is often political. But if she loved him, there's no reason why she shouldn't love him just because he's a poet. Doesn't make him the lowest of men because he's a poet and wants to celebrate. And God forbid a man has celebrated a woman. What a terrible crime. A man is so in love with a woman that he's celebrating.
Mary,
don't celebrate me.
She's about to explode. We must let her in.
This is a different kind of obstacle. You know, one of the obstacles to love is that the object of your affection does not love you. This is a very good love poem about obstacles just turned round.
No, the great love poem about this would be Orpheus writing about having read this poem. That would be the challenge.
In a way...
And I know what he'd say.
Well, of course he would. But what I think is also interesting about this is that this, or something of this tradition about is the woman just packaged to be the object of my affection, is actually already known certainly within Roman love poetry. I mean, one of the things that Ovid, for example, does in his poems written at the end of the 1st century BC called The Loves, the Amores, one of the things he does is he hits you in the face with his own realisation that his beautiful Corinna is actually the object of his own creation and is really just a piece of paper
I completely accept that. And the hero of my novel knows perfectly well that he's driving... He complains, for example, that every time he falls in love with a woman, she falls asleep and he thinks she's never going to wake up again. He knows that he bores them to death with his devotion.
So let
them speak.
That's fine.
That's funny and that's great. You can bore a person to death with your devotion, but that then is not a love story. It's a great story. It's just not a love story.
And they've got to shut up for eternity. No, Eurydice at last been allowed to speak.
Now, some of these great loves may never end, but I'm afraid we have to now. And many thanks indeed to my guests tonight, Howard Jacobson, Mary Beard, and Hayden Gwynn.
Rana Mitter was talking to the novelist Howard Jacobson and classicist Mary Beard. The reader was Hayden Gwynn, and the programme was produced by Allegra McElroy. Two great literary tales of star-crossed lovers, illicit passion and romantic tragedy are the subject of this evening's Prom, live from the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3. In the first part, we heard Berlioz's love scene for Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, and we're about to meet a couple from Celtic mythology, Tristan and Isolde, the second act of Wagner's opera, written in Italy 20 years after the Berlioz, with Sir Simon Rattle conducting the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. And for some of the wind players, this means a switch from French to German-style instruments, and for horn players, a change of technology. Here's principal horn player Andrew Clark.
Wagner would have been acutely aware of the ability of brass instruments to have valves, and in Tristan, although we have four valved horn players playing the parts for the orchestra, the six offstage parts are clearly natural horn parts. I think that in the 1850s, when he was writing this music, apart from the fact that it's very idiomatic to write for the natural horn, he might have found it quite difficult to get hold of 10 horn players for one performance, all of whom had valve horns.
The Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment's principal horn, Andrew Clark. And the second act of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde opens with the sound of those distant natural hunting horns. But I better do the story so far. In Act 1, Tristan is on a boat, returning to Cornwall with the Irish princess Isolde, who he's persuaded to marry his uncle, King Mark. But Tristan and Isolde have secretly and illicitly fallen in love, and when Tristan refuses to acknowledge her, Isolde decides to end both their lives with poison. But her maid, Brangaena, switches the drink for a love potion, and at last, as they both think they're about to die, they are free to acknowledge their love for each other. And that's where we come in. Tristan's friend Melot has persuaded King Mark to go hunting at night, leaving Tristan and Isolde alone in the royal castle. Almost alone, Brangaena warns Isolde that she suspects Melot of treachery, that he's arranged the hunt as a trap for the lovers. She can still hear the horn calls too close for comfort and refuses to extinguish the torch set up as a warning sign for Tristan. So Isolde snuffs it out herself, and Tristan arrives for the tryst. Wagner's Lovers are sung for us this evening by Violeta Umana and Ben Hepner.
In Act Two, Tristan and Isolde are getting together on a prearranged signal, a bit of a tryst, if you want to put it that way. So we're doing this in a clandestine way, hopefully out of the prying eyes of King Mark.
Yeah, at the beginning of the second act, Isolde is fighting with Brangaena, because Brangaena mentions that probably Melot is a bad man and he is not a friend. And then, of course, when Tristan arrives, it's the most passionate scene, maybe, in the opera history.
The music is unbelievable. Yeah. And then eventually they come upon the whole idea of perhaps the best way to consummate their love would be to die together. And it would be then eternal.
Ben Hepner and Violeta Umana, Tristan and Isolde at the proms this evening. So, Brangaena, keeping watch from her tower, lets out a scream as King Mark, Melot and the other courtiers return unexpectedly from their nocturnal hunt. The trap is sprung. Tristan's loyal servant, Corvinal, rushes in, shouting to Tristan to save himself, but he's too late. The lovers are seen in the garden, and King Mark confronts Tristan, grief-stricken at his friend's betrayal. Tristan can't answer him. Instead, he asks Isolde if she'll follow him into death, and she asks him to show her the path. Melot draws his sword and vows to avenge the king's honour, and Tristan lets his own sword fall, allowing himself to be critically wounded. Well, King Mark is sung by Franz Josef Zelig, Brangaena by Sarah Connolly, Melot by Timothy Robinson, and Corvinal by Henk Nathan. And as Tristan and Isolde, Ben Hepner and Violeta Umana. And here she is with Sarah Connolly as Brangaena and Sir Simon Rattle to conduct the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment in the second act of Wagner's opera Tristan und Isolde, with its great love duet. We're in King Mark's castle in Cornwall, the garden in front of Isolde's chamber, where the sounds of the hunt ring out.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, hear my flame, king of all life and of the living. auch seinen Neid erstickt mich. Sein Scheuchenzeichen zündet an und steckt an der liebsten Tür, das Licht ich zu ihr führe. Sonnen sind sie vor dem versponnen. Thank you.
Oh. wirklich wähnst du das?
Tristan. Amen.
The end of the second act of Wagner's opera Tristan und Isolde. And at the height of one of the most musically graphic love scenes, they've been caught in flagrante by King Mark, and Tristan sees that the only way he and Isolde will be united is in death. You've just heard Canadian tenor Ben Heppner as Tristan with Lithuanian soprano Violeta Urmana as Isolde, and Franz Josef Zelig as King Mark, Sarah Connolly as the maid Brangaena keeping watch from high above the orchestra next to the Royal Albert Hall's organ, which is probably still vibrating with the echoes of Wayne Marshall's Wagner recital on it this afternoon. Timothy Robinson sang Melut, and Henk Nathan had the briefest of roles, Kurvenal, trying desperately to warn Tristan that his affair was about to be discovered. Sir Simon Rattle conducted the orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, led this evening by Matthew Truscott. And what a special range of colours and sounds they brought to bear on Wagner's score, and a pretty dynamic, stunning dynamic range as well, as Ben Heppner was telling us earlier. And here they come, the full cast this time back, with Sarah Connolly, who's made it back down to the stage from her watchtower and a beautifully projected Brangaena. Simon Rattle and the orchestra applauding our soloists. And he goes across to shake the hands of Matthew Truscott and bring the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment to its collective feet for their own round of applause. What happened next? Well, Kurvenal takes the wounded Tristan to Brittany. Isolde sets out to meet him, but as her ship arrives, Tristan tears off his bandages and dies in her arms. Isolde reaches her own state of ecstasy, her transfiguration, as she nears the moment when she can fulfill her love for Tristan in death. By the way, if you'd like to hear more of Henk Nathan's voice after that tantalising cameo as Kurvenal, just three words, then you can. He joins soprano Malin Christensen for tomorrow's Proms Chamber Music at Cadogan Hall, a recital of songs by Brahms, Berg and Wolf, which you can hear live here on BBC Radio 3 at lunchtime tomorrow, 1 o'clock. And that was the first of Simon Rattle's Proms this season. He returns with, well, his other orchestra in early September. You might have heard of them, the Berlin Philharmonic. They'll be performing Wagner's Parsifal Prelude, as well as Beethoven and Mahler symphonies and Strauss's Four Last Songs with Carita Mattila. Well, back they come onto the stage again. We're back at the Royal Albert Hall for tomorrow evening's Prom at 7:30. Pierre-Laurent Aymar playing Mozart and Jonathan Nott conducting Ligeti, George Benjamin and Ravel. But as the cast take a bow after those powerful reminders from Berlioz, Wagner and Shakespeare that the course of true love never did run smooth, I'll return you to Broadcasting House, where I hope Andrew Lyle can offer us something to mend the wounded heart.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Our thanks to Andrew McGregor at the Albert Hall. And a reminder that there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom again this coming Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's Prom, then please visit bbc.co.uk/proms and click on Share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, we've a few moments in hand before tonight's drama on 3. So perhaps this would satisfy Andrew McGregor. Some piano music by Debussy with post-Wagnerian overtones. The movement Debussy called the Gollywog's Cakewalk from his Children's Corner Suite. The pianist in this recording is Arturo Benedetti Michelangeli.
Thank you.
Arturo Benedetti Michelangeli playing the last movement of Debussy's Children's Corner Suite, the movement he called Golliwog's Cakewalk, preceded, I have to admit, with inadvertently the first note of Act Two of Wagner's Tristan. My apologies for that finger trouble on my part. And with children in mind, a brief look ahead to 10:15 tonight, where in Words and Music there's an edition that they called The Prodigy, dedicated to writings and music by youthful prodigies and the early work of great artists. Readings by Jack Lasky and Ellie Kendrick from Poetry and Prose by Keats, Rambo, Byron, Robert Graves and Daisy Ashford. And music from Mendelssohn and Paganini, performances from prodigies such as Daniel Barenboim and Hilary Hahn. That's 10:15 tonight, Words and Music. But now on BBC Radio 3 at 9:15, time for tonight's drama on 3, Light of Darkness by Louis Naura. Louis Naura is one of Australia's leading writers, and his work includes libretti, novels and stage plays, as well as a number of pre-Italia-winning radio dramas. He's written about historical Russia, Paraguay and Indonesia. And now in this new play for Radio 3, he turns to the Ottoman Empire, specifically a rural province of Turkey in 1915. Here he creates a story of an embattled diplomat forced to play a cat-and-mouse game with local dignitaries during an era of Turkish history which remains deeply contested. Naura was drawn to this period after hearing a piece of music by the Armenian composer Komitas, who was arrested in 1915, and some of whose music is used in the play. That led Naura to the discovery of the writings of an American consul in the region, Leslie A. Davis, which inspired tonight's drama.
The Light of Darkness by Louis Naura.
Them. Wagons and horses.
Give me a look.
You might have to change the focus.
What's wrong with your eyes? It's completely out of focus. There. Coming down the main street. It must be them. What does the consul look like?
I don't know. Let me look.
No. Maybe he's the one with the cowboy hat.
What's a cowboy hat?
Like Buffalo Bill.
Give me a turn. No, he must be the consul's guard. That other fellow sitting on the front of the wagon, he looks important.
Where's his wife?
There's an American flag painted on the side. It is them. Get all the staff to the front door. Now!
Come on, hurry up!
A straight line, the consul is coming. The consul is coming. Everyone in a line. A straight line. Oh, open it! Open the door! Oh, goodness!
Who's in charge here?
Mr. Petrosian.
You?
Yes, sir. Do you want me to help the consul?
I am the consul. Who are you?
Garabit Petrosian, Mr. Consul. I'm your messenger, Kavas, and now Dragoman.
Kavas, Dragoman. Wonderful titles. Translation, you're my interpreter in aid.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
And who are you?
Miss Shushan Krikorian, Mr. Consul.
Miss?
Yes, I am your secretary and typist and can interpret Armenian and Turkish.
Excellent. Now do we have a cook?
Yes, sir. Mrs. Balakian here.
Mr. Consul!
Madam, I want food as soon as possible for everyone out there. I want real meat. No goat meat, and I want it fresh.
She doesn't speak English.
Well, you make sure she does it. I want a hot bath now. I've been eating dust for weeks. Damn lice in my hair. And my rear has never been so sore.
Will I get someone to help your wife, sir?
She's back in the States. I want my horse fed and washed down. Now, where's my bedroom? And have someone look after the others.
This way to your sleeping quarters, sir.
Yes? Guest bed.
Garab bed.
Got my glass of whiskey?
You ordered one, sir.
Oh, I'm dying of thirst. Hand it over. Haven't you seen a man having a bath before?
Yes, sir, but not a consul.
Last few weeks, I slept on the roofs of inns, unable to get to sleep because it was so cold. And all I could do was dream of whiskey warming up my insides.
You slept on the roofs?
Mm-hmm. The others slept in the wagons. Turkish inns, I have discovered, are filthy and full of lice. And it got worse the further we came. No wonder typhus is rampant. Will you look at the water? It's as muddy as the Mississippi. Imagine the dirt and dust that's still in my pores. That nice lambent warmth spreading through my skin. Oh. Before dinner, I want to see the papers that the previous consul was supposed to give me.
You didn't get them. They were sent to your previous posting 3 weeks ago.
Well, it's taken me 3 weeks to get here from the Black Sea.
There's no rail service or good roads here, sirs.
As I've discovered.
And sometimes the mail takes an inordinate amount of time to travel distances.
What about commercial opportunities here?
Commercial opportunities?
Give me a straight answer.
Harpot has a warehouse full of Singer sewing machines. They sell well.
Sewing machines are always needed. What else? Manufacturing?
There's a few small silk farms.
That's it?
This is a very remote district, Mr. Consul, and with no real transport system. Everything we grow or make is just for the people who live here.
So the idea of me developing commercial interests for the United States is a chimera.
A chimera?
An illusion, a daydream.
Yes, both words would be applicable to your situation, Consul.
That is a wonderful introduction to Harput. My dragoman, my kavas, my interpreter. You don't look Turkish, Garabit.
Armenian, sir. We're Christian. We're not Turks and not Muslims.
And you all get along with brotherly love?
You're not religious, sir.
My stomach's rumbling, or else something else is happening down in the boondocks. A towel there, thanks. Oh, I'm famished.
Do you want me to...
You always answer knocking at your door.
Yes? Thank you.
When is it?
Your clean boots and a note saying that Mr. Rashid, the local chief of police, and Mr. Sabit, the valet, have noticed your arrival and would like the honor of meeting the new American consul to Harput.
By valet, you mean the local governor?
Yes.
What's he like?
He seems to enjoy life very much.
The chief of police?
Oh, he believes in everything he does.
Oh, dear.
Good morning, Consul Davis.
Good morning, Governor. This is my aide and interpreter, Garabit Petrosian.
We know you're Armenian dragoman. This is Rashid Bey, Chief of Police.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Bey.
No, Consul. Bey means Mr.
Günaydın, Consulus Bey.
Doesn't understand a word of English. Don't let the baby face fool you, Consul. Our Chief of Police may look 14, but he makes up for it in his actions, as his aide will attest when he didn't press the Chief's uniform properly. Sit down, sit down. I'll order some coffee and sweets. Your Armenian can sit over there. Cafe, Hemon. What brings you to this remote spot, Consul?
The State Department sent me here.
Where were you previously?
Batum, on the Black Sea. It was my first posting.
I've heard you didn't bring a wife.
She couldn't put up with the tropical climate at Batum, the heat and the rain. So she returned to the United States to recover her health.
Perhaps just as well. I have two wives. Sometimes they argue so much. My problem is that I've only got two bedrooms, so there's always a quarrel around bedtime. The only thing they understand is a spank. They calm down after that. Do you spank your wife, Mr. Consul?
Not lately.
Hiç Bağdat'a bulundunuz mu, Consulus Bey?
Have you been to Baghdad, Mr. Consul?
No.
Yes?
No.
The chief of police understands only one word of English, yes.
Yes.
But refuses to recognize the word no for some reason.
Tırram, tırram, Bağdat'ta otomobilim vardı.
We had an automobile in Baghdad.
There are rumors of what our chief of police here learned as a teenager in Baghdad, and they're not nice. He was brought up here, but the locals know he can't be bribed. I taught him poker. He proved a natural, but he doesn't even cheat. An incorruptible policeman in the Ottoman Empire is almost unheard of, Mr. Consul. Once we almost ruled the whole world, and now look at us. Do you know much about this province, Consul?
My transfer came so quickly, I hardly had time to do any research.
We are 500,000 people, and that includes about 150,000 Christians.
You mean Armenians? I know next to nothing about them.
There's something that we Turks have had to put up with for some time. Is that not right, dragoman?
I have no opinion. I am just the consul's dragoman and interpreter.
So you don't speak Turkish or Armenian, Mr. Consul?
No. French, Spanish, Russian, German.
All useless here, I'm afraid, Mr. Consul.
Your English is good.
My father had an English tutor for me. He thought I would be a diplomat like you. I could have been one, only I lost my temper with the American ambassador in Constantinople. You Americans can be swine, Consul. You think you own the world when you're really products of a simple and frontier civilization. Our history goes back thousands of years. Dr. Atkinson, the doctor at the Red Cross Hospital here, he's a nice American. He doesn't think he runs the world. Dr. Atkinson and I talk about the world as equals.
I'm sorry that we Americans have lacked humility in your presence.
When I saw you ride into Harput, Mr. Consul, riding that horse, wearing those boots and hat, you reminded me of the hero from Last of the Mohicans. What's his name?
Natty Bumpo.
A nice but uncivilized warrior. Have you killed any Red Indians, Consul?
I grew up on Long Island. There were no Indians left.
They're all gone?
Yes.
Perhaps all to the good of your nation.
Hiç tayareye bindiniz mi?
Have you been in an aeroplane, Consul?
No.
Yes?
Yok.
Eşitiz o zaman.
Then we're equal.
The chief of police believes that there will be a war soon.
Ben bir tayarenin bomba atışını gördüm. Gelecek işte böyle olacak.
The chief of police saw an aeroplane drop bombs. He says it is the future.
That's because he's half my age, Consul. He thinks that everything new is going to change the future.
And on what side will the Turks fight, Governor?
Why, the French and English sides, of course. I have a feeling, Consul Davis, that we're going to be firm friends. N'est-ce pas?
Oui. So, the prognosis is not good. This province has no commerce of any importance at all. This has to be one of the most dismal backblocks in the world. Don't type that. What do you people do for fun around here? Bite the heads off rats?
The consulate doesn't have any rats, as far as I know of. There are some nice places around Harput, sir.
Like what?
Lake Gülcük. Dr. Atkinson and the previous consul used to picnic there often.
Mm. How long will this letter take to get to Constantinople?
Perhaps 3 weeks.
Mm. Entree!
The mail, sir.
Thank you. Any from the embassy in Constantinople?
This one, sir.
Oh.
Is that all the mail to be taken to the post office?
Yes. Is anything the matter, Mr. Davis?
My father is dying. Very attractive lake. You are right, Shushan.
Do you want the blanket here?
Dr. Atkinson, Shushan told me you know this lake well.
Lake Gülcük is the closest place I know to a place of beauty and solitude. It's the only spot where I can relax. Hospital's always full, and being a doctor takes up all my time. When I come out here, I can sense God in the waters. The bulrushes in the mountains.
Well, there's plenty of bread and cheese, but where's the wine?
Ganovitz bringing it, sir.
When do you set off?
Tomorrow. I feel like I only just got here. Now I have that bone-breaking ride to Constantinople and then the ship back to the States.
It's terminal?
The embassy didn't say, except that he had cancer. Which, as a doctor, you know my father doesn't stand much chance. I must see him before he dies. Oh, it is calming, isn't it? Lake reminds me of Port Jefferson, where I grew up. I used to wait in the morning to see the fishing boats come in after being out all night. My father's boat was the pick of the bunch. Who's that riding over here?
That's Garabit.
I'm going to have to teach him to ride properly. That one's out of control. He'd better not break the wine bottles.
The previous consul was Catholic. And what religious persuasion are you, Mr. Davis?
Mr. Davis! Mr. Davis!
What's he shouting about?
He seems upset.
Mr. Davis!
Consul Davis.
Well, maybe he's found some nice French wines.
Mr. Davis, Consul.
What is it? Have you found a nice Burgundy?
War is declared.
War? Between whom?
The Turks have declared war on the English and French.
You mean they're on Germany's side?
Yes, sir.
What about America?
You're neutral, sir.
What's the town crier saying?
All men between the ages of 25 and 45 are to enroll in the army within 24 hours or else they'll be drawn and quartered.
Good Lord, if that's what they do to their own men, imagine what they'll do to the enemy. Yeah, we'll take a shortcut to the governor's.
Over there, sir. He's crossing the square.
Ah, yeah. Governor!
What is it you want to see me about so urgently, Mr. Davis?
I come here in an official capacity.
What is this? Official capacity?
The American government is not at war with Turkey. And as I am its consul here in Harput, I'd like confirmation that our American missionaries will not be harmed. Did I say something amusing, Governor?
You have no official capacity, Mr. Consul.
Governor, I am the consul.
With our declaration of war, we have redefined our relationship with the rest of the world. We do not recognize any foreign representatives in an official capacity.
We are not at war with you.
Mr. Davis, we Turkish people are proud people, and we've decided we will not stand for any more bullying from foreign nations. I can run you out of town whenever I like, or take over the consulate at the snap of my fingers. It is something I wouldn't mind. I need a larger house for my wives. What do you think of that?
The international diplomatic community would regard it as a hostile act.
What the world is not used to is that we Ottomans can now decide our own fate.
Well, where does that leave me?
Think of yourself as a visitor at my mercy. No, no, not mercy. My good humor. At the mercy of my good humor. And you?
Me?
You are an Ottoman citizen and aged between 25 and 45. Have you signed up yet?
He's my aide. He belongs to the consulate.
I don't think you heard me. He belongs to our country, not to a visitor such as yourself. What do you think of my nephew, the drummer boy?
He seems good for his age.
He is, but no one else will play music with him because he farts all the time.
You told me the Turks hate the Germans.
We do, but as Allah constantly reminds us humans, we must submit to what life throws at us. The war ministry was split between the Ottomans joining the Allies or Germany, and Germany won by a single vote. So our whole fate has been determined by one man. In doing so, he has given us the freedom to run our own country free from interference. Must go. Here comes my nephew, and even in an open space, he's a walking stink bomb. Good day, Mr. Davis.
So, Mr. Ambassador, because of this province's remoteness, I have no idea if the governor's willful actions are those of his alone, or are the Turkish government's contempt for international law. Would you please inform me as soon as possible as to the present state of affairs? I suspect that if I return to the United States, the governor may take the opportunity to close down or take over the consulate for the Turkish government. Please keep me informed as to my father's health, as I am very concerned about him. Signed, respectfully yours, Leslie A. Davis, Consul Harput. And address it as usual to the Honorable Henry Morgenthau, American Ambassador, Constantinople.
What about your wife, Mr. Davis? Shouldn't you let her know you won't be going back to America?
I'll write her this evening. What do you know about this governor, Shushan?
I've only lived in Harput for 6 months, Mr. Davis, when I came here to work from Erzurum, northeast of here.
You worked in a consulate there?
No, sir. I was training with the American College to become a teacher. My uncle and auntie are teachers in Massachusetts. I was hoping to follow them there after perfecting my English.
You must be 20...
21.
You got plenty of time.
If we survive this war.
They can't harm you. You have diplomatic immunity because you work here.
Garabit said that the governor doesn't recognize diplomat immunity.
He will. All we have to do is be diplomatic. How are the replies to the invitations, Garabit?
Nearly everyone has accepted. They all want to know what's going to happen.
Me too.
I haven't been back to the States in 10 years now. I'm not needed back there, but I am here, Mrs. Riggs.
I hear you're going to teach at Cornell, Professor Nassessian. I studied there myself.
The present attitude of the Turks towards us Armenians means I would never get a university position in Constantinople. I'll not be sorry to miss Harput summers. They're hideous.
What'll you be teaching, Professor?
Philosophy. English idealists like Bishop Berkeley.
Didn't he say that nothing is real? And Dr. Johnson countered him by kicking a stone.
Dr. Johnson may have been an excellent writer, but I would have failed him in philosophy.
Dr. Atkinson, what do you think of this young chief of police?
What I think, Mr. Davis, is that someone who loathes people suffers himself from self-loathing. So he's a very dangerous and disturbed young man. Trianne here had to treat him recently.
He has a bad constipation problem, which only makes his temper worse.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming tonight. I hope you like the food. Mrs. Balakian and I have daily battles about what she's going to cook, but I think we found a good medium tonight. You're all obviously worried about the situation here. The first thing to note is that America is not at war with Turkey, so we are neutral and hope to be treated as such. So far, the war hasn't come to the eastern provinces. The English and French missionaries have gone
home.
And
the Turks have commandeered their buildings for troops.
It's thought that the soldiers will come through here on their way to protect their eastern border with Russia. The governor can occasionally see reason when he's allowed Dr. Atkinson to keep running his hospital.
Because, quite simply, there's no other hospital of its standards in the region, so the governor has commandeered it. Let me say to you all here tonight, the Turkish troops are badly nourished, poorly clothed, and paid little. There's a typhus epidemic at the front. It's only a matter of time before it gets here. So, everyone sprinkle naphthalene around your offices and wear naphthalene bands around necks, arms, and legs in order to prevent lice from crawling onto your body.
What about the Armenians, Mr. Davis?
What about them?
There are rumors that the day before the Allies landed at Gallipoli on April 24th, over 200 important Armenian intellectuals and artists were arrested in Constantinople. It's thought that most were murdered.
Why?
Because they're Armenian. If it's as bad as what happened in the early 90s, then they're in trouble.
I don't know much about this history.
There are 2 million Armenians living in the Empire. There's always rumors that the Armenians are a fifth column in the country.
We just have to trust the fact that we are neutral, and that the governor will respect that. In all likelihood, the Turks will lose this war. They're unprepared. Even the Germans regard them as a joke. But anyone who wants to leave can be assured I will supply them with guards for the journey. I take it, then, that you're all staying.
Yes. We are here to save lives.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's all rise and toast President Wilson. President Wilson.
President
Wilson. President Wilson.
Mrs. Balakian, what have I done wrong now?
Mr. Davis, Garabit has been arrested and has been taken to prison.
Garabit is my right-hand man. He is essential to my work. I need him to interpret and to guide me in my job.
What job? You don't have a job. You have no official function at all. You are merely staying in the largest house in the district. In other words, you are my guest. And so you are at the mercy of your host's whims. So what has this Armenian been arrested for?
Not signing up in the army.
If he didn't, then he is in trouble. Go and speak to the chief of police.
He arrested my dragoman.
Then you are in trouble.
Can't you have a word with him?
He's the only person I'm scared of in my province, and that includes the Kurds.
I have heard that many Turks have bought their way out of the army, so I would like to offer...
Have I heard you say that men buy their way out of serving in our army?
Yes.
Thank goodness you're no longer a diplomat, Mr. Davis. You'll never get anywhere disparaging your hosts. Now, I am engaged in a diplomatic act of my own, trying to satisfy 2 wives in 1 evening. Good night, Mr. Davis.
Niçin buradasınız?
Konsolos Bey için tercüme yapıyorum.
Bir kadının benim dediklerimi tercüme etmesini istemiyorum. Sana güvenmiyorum.
What's the problem?
He doesn't want a woman interpreting for him. He doesn't trust women.
Mr. Chief of Police, you have my interpreter in your cells. Release him and you don't have to have Miss Krikorian in the room.
Give up on Garabit.
Now just wait a damn minute.
Found him. Oh, Tabi. Tabi. Valibe.
The governor's on the telephone.
Tamam. Tamam. Tabi. Baş üstüne Valibe. Şimdilik Ermeninizi geri arabalıyormuşsunuz.
We can have Garabit back, but just for the time being.
Thank you, Mr. Chief of Police.
Teşekkür ederim, Reis Bey.
Ermenisin. Ama pek de güzelsin. Go.
We'll wait outside for him. Good morning, sir. Well, what did he say to you?
For an Armenian, I'm quite attractive.
The Chief of Police is right for once.
I'll be glad when Garabit has to deal with him.
Why?
He always looks at me like a predator sizing up its prey.
Ah, just stay still. Shushan, could you wipe the dirt near the wound? Did all the men who didn't report for duty get abused?
Only the Armenians, sir. Some of the men they were beating up were old. Too old to fight. Teachers. Professors.
Well, if they're too old to join, well, why are they filling the prison with them?
It's nothing to do with the army, Mr. Davis. The Turks are using the war as a cover to kill Armenians.
Mr. Davis, Garabit is right. You must get the governor to stop this.
I've heard Garabit's version, that's all.
You don't believe me? Sir, listen to me. I heard those men being tortured. The Turks are convinced that Armenians have stored up arms and ammunition to use the war to revolt against them. I spoke to some of them. No one has any weapons. Ouch!
But the Turks and Armenians have gone through this before.
Those were terrible times, but I think this sudden violence, maybe because of direct orders from Constantinople.
Oh, you don't know that for certain.
I think the Chief of Police believes he's doing the job that Constantinople wants.
The Chief of Police was born here. His father hated Armenians, and so does his son.
It's quite probable that the governor and chief of police are taking the law into their own hands. Anything is possible out here. Shushan, answer that.
I'm afraid for those men in prison, sir. The police were erecting a fence at the rear of the prison to house more Armenians.
Hold still. I'm gonna put some stitches in it.
You know how to do this, sir.
Oh, I had to stitch up my own leg one day when I was involved in a damn fall in the Rockies. My horse fell with me, so I practiced on it first. You're gonna have quite a fetching scar on your forehead. Who was it?
Dr. Atkinson. He wanted you to know that the chief of police has rounded up 800 men. As he was saying that the prisoners were going to be deported in the morning, our telephone went dead, like the line had been cut.
Well, we know who's done that.
I don't have much time, Mr. Davis, but I've asked that someone takes care of your telephone line.
Are you going back to Constantinople?
A brief vacation north with my wives, Mr. Davis.
I wish to complain about the treatment of those prisoners. There must be 800 men locked up.
You cannot make official complaints.
Unofficial, then?
Why would I pay attention to an unofficial complaint? You don't have to worry about them. You see, Mr. Davis, they are being deported.
Deported where?
They will find out when they get there. Now, Mr. Davis, I'm going to vacation on the Black Sea. In my absence, Rashid Bey, the chief of police, will be in charge of the deportation, and you'd better not get in his way.
Governor.
One more thing, Consul. Both the chief of police and I want you to know that any time you venture out of the city, you are to give us your itinerary a day in advance. If you don't, then you will be treated like everyone else and will be put to death.
Come in. Come in.
My sincere apologies, sir, for waking you up this late.
Oh, it's been a restless night anyway.
One of Dr. Atkinson's nurses is at the door asking if you would go to the hospital.
Now?
Yes, sir.
It'll seem suspicious that I'm going to the hospital at this hour.
I'm sorry about the lateness, Mr. Davis, but as you'll see, we've put him in here. It's the only place we could hide him. Two of the wards are filled with Turkish soldiers. You remember my pharmacist from our dinner at the consulate, Dekran Turian?
Of course I do. Hello, Mr. Turian.
Mr. Consul.
As you can see, the only way he made it here was to dress as a woman. Remember the chief of police sending off those 800 prisoners? The so-called deportation? Well, they were taken to a valley a few hours away. They were still tied together in bunches and were told to sit and wait for water. As they did, the police started shooting. After a few rounds, that killed most of the men. Men were tied up to dead men, could not run away. They were screaming and cursing. The order was given not to waste any more bullets, so they bayoneted the rest. Turian here escaped. Turian.
I was at the end. The end of the line. They were shooting everyone. I hear the order to bayonet us. I cry out. I cry in terror and told them to shoot me. I do not want to be dead because of a bayonet. I want to die because of a bullet. It hurts not so much.
And then?
I eat.